Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Monday, April 4th, 2016. It is 9:08 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Kelly.
Good morning.
Senator Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Bishop is on other state business for the day, so he won't be at this morning's meeting or this afternoon's meeting. And Senator Machicki is out of the building and en route to us and should be joining us shortly. On today's agenda, we have SB 91, SB 145, SB 147. I suppose I should say what those are. SB 91 is the Omnibus Crime Bill. SB 145 is daycare assistance and child care grants. SB 147 is senior benefit program eligibility. SB 170 is DNR fees for geological services. SB 174 is regarding firearms, knives by the University of Alaska. All those bills have been previously heard. The public hearing was open and closed. And those, with the support of the committee, will be up before us again, if necessary, an adoption of a CS that is available to the general public as we speak. And then on their way to the Rules Committee. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Senator Kelly, may I have a motion on SB 91?
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 91 Finance, version 29- I'll say it again so it's clearly on the record. Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 91 Finance, version 29-LS0541, /F as in Franco, before the committee as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion, Mr. Schilling. And we'll say F as in finance, right?
All right.
Mr. Schilling, can you, to the best of your ability at this point, give us a brief rundown on the CS before us? We expect, as I understand it, that it contains the amendments and the amendments to the amendments that we offered yesterday, as well as technical changes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, for the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. I do not have a comprehensive list in front of me, but my understanding is that the CS simply incorporates the amendments that the committee offered and adopted on Saturday.
Thank you very much. Brief at ease. Record. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. The CS is before us, and as I stated, we're going to set it aside and let all eyes in the Capitol and in Alaska take a look at this to make sure that we've got it right. We are still working on amendment number one that became, I think, amendment number 27 or 6 yesterday. We still don't have that quite right. Is that on arrests?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So we're still working with the Department of Law, the Public Defender's Office. Senator Coghill, did you have any comments that you'd like to make on the CS as it stands before us resting today?
Madam Chair, Senator Coghill, Senator from North Pole, Fairbanks area. First of all, thank you for the work that you did Saturday. There were many policy calls that I thought were appropriate. But I just wanted the committee to know that as the commission put this together and as the bill came to the legislature, both the governor and the two presiding officers of both bodies gave kind of the how do you get the least amount of cost and the most amount of public safety. And as we went through the bill, the public safety issue, mostly on sex offense issues, became very, very clear that the cost savings did not reach the level of the public safety. The public safety trumped it, is what I'm saying. And I think some of the things that you did in ironing out some of those areas were totally appropriate. Some of the applicability was totally appropriate. And so the amendments I watched, I was a part of watching them come and go and get adopted in the debate. So I think public safety, which does mean, to be fair, that the fiscal notes will probably come in a little bit less than had been stated as the bill was introduced. On the other hand, I think the people of Alaska, from your work here in this committee, will know that their accountability measures trump some of the cost savings. And so for that, I'm grateful. I think that's it's well done.
Further comments from committee members? Thank you, Senator Coghill. Thank you, Mr. Shillings. With that, we will set 29-LS0541F aside. We're waiting for updated fiscal notes, and we are still waiting for that amendment. So if the amendment is crafted appropriately, that it meets all the hurdles to get into the bill, we may offer that amendment at the afternoon meeting. But beside that, we're waiting for fiscals now. That will rest till at least Tuesday morning, if not Wednesday. If I could direct the committee's attention to SB 145.
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 145, Finance, version 29-GS2769/W before the committee as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Ms. Schein.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Erin Schein. I'm staff to Senator McKinnon and the Senate Finance Committee. The CS before you for Senate Bill 145 makes a change. We previously had a version before us that allowed PFD garnishment for daycare assistance and child care grants over payments. In the hearing with a companion bill in the other body, it came to light that there are two other benefit programs than under public assistance that do not have this ability to garnish PFDs, and that is the senior benefits program and the heating assistance. So the CS before you allows the Department of Public Assistance to garnish all for all public assistance programs.
Are there questions from committee members on the CS for Senate Bill 145, an act relating to benefit for public assistance program administered by the Department of Health and Social Services and providing for an effective date? Seeing and hearing none, I withdraw my objection, and the CS is before us. Is there anyone here from the governor's office that wishes to testify on the CS for SB 145. Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Your name for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sean O'Brien. I'm the Director for the State Division of Public Assistance under the Department of Health and Social Services. And with regards to Senate Bill 145, I really don't have anything to add. I'm mostly here available for questions. But the change, again, as you stated, primarily is just to make sure we keep the option available for PFD garnishment across all of our programs. We already have it for most of them. We felt like it was important for the sake of not only equity, but for the sake of administering the program that we're basically consistent. And so this is certainly a change that we support. So I'm here to address any questions that anyone may have.
Mr. O'Brien, do we need to update any fiscal notes or the fiscal notes that we have, the correct fiscal notes?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the $500,000 receipt recovery is probably still very, very close. We didn't submit a revised fiscal note simply because the vast majority of funds that we anticipate will come through the child care program. The only other two programs affected in this case for the amendment would be the senior benefits program and the HAP, Alaska Heating Assistance Program. And we just, in the analysis that we did, didn't really see an appreciable change. And we currently have in the fiscal note $500,000 anticipated recovery period, which we feel would actually cover all of our programs. And it is an estimate.
We'll have Senator Michicki cover the fiscal notes in just a moment. Is there any further questions for Mr. O'Brien? Senator Olson.
And I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time to go into it, but as I'm reading the fiscal notes, it looks like there's a change from federal funds going over to general funds. Is that, am I reading them correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the way that works is the funds, primarily in this case the child care funds, our federal funds. And so if we are not able to recoup those funds, we have to pay for that difference out of general fund. So it's a situation where if we can recoup the funds, we would receive those funds and offset the cost and transfer those that way, as opposed to potentially losing the general fund, which we would have to pay back if we didn't recoup the federal funds. Does that help?
If I could continue, Madam Chairman.
General Olson.
So as I'm reading, the general fund's taking a hit of $500,000.
The general funds could take a hit of $500,000 if we didn't have the ability to recoup the federal funding.
And you look at this as positive?
We look at it as a neutral offset.
No further questions, Madam Chairman.
Any further questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Yep. Senator Michiki, if I could have you go through all three fiscal notes before us.
Madam Chair, my packet has two fiscal notes, number two and number three. I do not have number one in my packet.
I do not have number one either. Brief at ease. Welcome back to Senate Finance. Senator Michiki, we had previously introduced you. You've been with us some time, but just wanted to make sure that the record noted that Senator Michiki has been here. Senator Michiki, can you cover the two fiscal notes, number two and three, and as I understand it, three replaced number one? Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number two is Department of Revenue. appropriation is taxation and treasury, allocation is permanent fund dividend division. OMB component number is 981, and the shows a zero operating. Essentially, it shows a zero fiscal note with no capital, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Fiscal note number three, which replaces fiscal note number one, is Department of Health and Social Services, Public Assistance, Child Care Benefits, and the OMB component number is 1897. Shows a zero operating fiscal note, and shows for the fund source, federal receipts of $500,000 a year and general fund program authority of $500,000 a year. And I understand we have other questions about the absolute effect of this fiscal note, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. And that would be, it shows a reduction of $500,000 of federal receipts and a new expenditure of $500,000 of general funds. Is that accurate?
That's a question that we have to answer. To me, it shows a wash of federal receipts offsetting, but I think that's the question of the day, Madam Chair.
So the committee is going to hold this, and I will talk with Legislative Finance about zeroing the general funds that are associated with this. That is the issue. So we'll set this bill aside and hopefully have it back up this afternoon as we get further clarification from the department. The next bill before us is SB 147, Senior Benefit Program Eligibility.
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 147, Health and Social Services Committee version. The version number is 29.GS2770/W. I'm just going to restate that. It is 29-GS2770 /W. And Madam Chair, did you want this moved from committee with or for a working document?
Mr. Co-Chairman, we already have it as a working document.
Okay.
I believe that motion is in preparation to move the bill from committee. So we have the CS for Senate Bill number 147 has before us. Version W was adopted on before us. The public hearing was opened on 3/15/2016 and closed.
So, Madam Chair, you're looking for a motion from committee?
Not just yet.
Okay.
Senator Machicki, could you cover the fiscal note on SB 147?
Yes, ma'am. Fiscal note says number two, which is the only one I have, Department of Health and Social Services, Public Assistance, the allocation of Senior Benefits Payment Program, and the OMB component number is 2897. This shows no operating expenditures for FY17, and it looks to me like savings begin in FY18 throughout FY22 of $43,200 a year. And then we look at the fund source for the, it's a 1004 general fund, again, from FY18 through 22, no capital, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Three for these. We're back on the record. Mr. O'Brien, I'm looking at a conversation from Legislative Finance that's indicating that we may need to reduce this fiscal note as far as the savings go. Can you speak to that?
For the record, again, this is Sean O'Brien, the director for the Division of Public Assistance, Health and Social Services, and the fiscal note, and I'm referencing 2897, OMB component number, reflects an approximate $43,000 savings effective in 18 as a result of both us allowing to administer the program a little more efficiently, because this particular addition would really create a level playing field in terms of the U.S. Citizenship requirement of all of our other DPA programs. So that gains some efficiency. We also, at current count, recognize we have about 16 individuals currently who would not meet the eligibility guidelines under the proposed rules for U.S. citizenship. So there would be some cost savings there as well. And so the original, I believe the original fiscal note that we submitted has not changed. I think it's still $43,000 fiscal note savings starting in 18.
Senator Machicki.
So the only change is following the citizen and or qualified alien requirement. How does that deliver a savings? Is it just a simpler process, and that's a time savings per applicant? Or how do you arrive at that $43,000?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, if you don't mind, I would like to call up our chief of policy. This is really her. She's our subject matter expert on this and probably could explain it better than I.
For the record, my name is Monica Windham. I'm Chief of Policy and Program Development for the Division of Public Assistance. Senator Machicki, through the chair, the savings comes from those 16 people that we've identified that do not meet the citizenship requirements. We'll be able to close those cases.
I got you.
Any further questions? Do we feel comfortable moving with this fiscal note?
One more question, Madam Chair. I was just going to, when you look on a per... If I may, is it the same cost per person, easy enough to calculate just by closing out the cases?
Yes, sir, it is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Is there any further questions on SB 147? Senator Kelly, could I have a motion to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 147 Hess, version 29-GS2770/W from committee with the attached fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill 147 moves from committee. We'll have a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. We're back on the record. The next bill before the Senate Finance Committee is the CS for Senate Bill Number 170, Resources. It's 29-LS1400-W. The public hearing was open and closed on 3-17-2016. If I could invite Ike Jalopsos from Senator Giesel's office to the microphone. Welcome back to Senate Finance.
Good morning, Madam Chairman.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Ike Jalopsos, staff to Senator Kathy Giesel, who is the sponsor for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jalopsos. Is there any questions before we consider the fiscal note on the CS for Senate Bill Number 170, Resources? If you could stay at the table, Ike, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I only have one fiscal note for Senate Bill 170. The Department of Natural Resources. Appropriation is fire suppression, land and water resources. The allocation is geological and geophysical surveys. The OMB component number is 1031. I show a change in their zero operating cost from FY17 through 22, Madam Chair. And the only thing I show on the fiscal note is a change in revenues to the positive of $85,000 in FY17, and then it graduates at $200,000 in FY18, $275,000 in 19, $350,000 in 20, $425,000 in 21, and $485,000 in FY22.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Machicki, I just provided you a document from Legislative Finance.
This document's dated 3/14 of 16. It says there are no technical issues with this fiscal note. An earlier version omitted the change in revenues, but that has been corrected. Under the scenario contemplated in the fiscal note, fee revenues would not be utilized for division operations. Instead, they would go to the general fund until program receipts reach $400,000 annually. At that time, the Geologic Materials Center would join the public building fund. This is projected to occur in FY2021 and would reduce capital costs for the operations of the center. Until that time, program receipts could replace UGF in the operating budget.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Just wanted to put that on the record that it is diverting these funds to the general fund for some time, but then it will join another area of state agencies for operation replacement value and maintenance. Is there any further questions for the sponsor? Senator Kelly, may I have a motion to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 170, Resources, version 29-LS1400-W, from committee with the attached fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, that bill moves from committee. The CS for Senate Bill 170, Resources. Thank you, Ike.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. on the record. The next bill before the committee is the CS for Senate Bill number 174, Finance. It's sponsored by Senator Kelly. It's an act relating to the regulation of firearms and knives by the University of Alaska. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 174, Finance, version 29-LS1306/I, before the committee as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion and invite Mr. Joe Burns to the microphone. Mr. Burns, if you could identify yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Burns, staff Senator Pete Kelly.
Mr. Burns, could you walk us through the changes in the CS?
Certainly. Starting on page 2, under AS14.40.173B in the bill, which adds exceptions to the Board of Regents' prohibition from regulating the possession, ownership, use, carrying, registration, storage, or transportation of concealed handguns or knives, removed the lines when the behavior of a student or an employee demonstrates that the student or employee poses a risk of harm to self or others. We removed in university facilities where health services, counseling services, or other services related to sexual harassment or violence are provided, and the line in university facilities during adjudication of staff or students' disciplinary issues was also removed. On page 2, line 8, from the language which allowed
Madam
the
Chair,
Board
if I
of Regents.
Just interrupt for a second, just for the committee, just so we know the. Thank you. This is some of this language has been moved to another section. It hasn't necessarily been removed completely from the bill. So I know some of those issues are very important to you. Go ahead, Mr. Burns, or Madam Chair.
Mr. Burns, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, line 8, from the language which allowed the Board of Regents to adopt and enforce policies regarding openly carried firearms, we remove the terms possession, ownership, use, registration, storage, transportation, and knives. Also on page 2, lines 15 through 18, in the language which allows the Board of Regents to adopt and enforce policies restricting possession of firearms and knives in restricted access areas, as defined on page 4, we add the words, which may include university-designated rooms where sexual assault, sexual harassment, or domestic violence are investigated and victim assistance is provided, and in university-designated rooms during adjudication of staff or student disciplinary issues. Then on page 2, lines 21 through 31, and page 3, lines 1 through 2, adds a new subsection that requires the Board of Regents, if the Board of Regents adopts a policy regulating concealed carry in dormitories, it must require one, if the person is not a resident of the dormitory, the owner shall carry the handgun on their person at all times. And two, if the person is a resident of the dormitory, the handgun is stored in an owner-provided lockbox at all times. He or she is not carrying the handgun. The owner is responsible for ensuring the storage is in compliance with state law. The owner may not leave the handgun in a lockbox unattended in a dormitory room for more than one day. And the owner must declare to the university that the owner intends to keep the weapon in the owner's dormitory room. And on page 3, lines 3 through 11, it specifies that the university may privately collect and store for not more than 1 year information regarding a student who intends to keep a weapon in the student's dormitory room. The university may use that information when making housing decisions for students who express they don't wish to share a dormitory room with a person who possesses a firearm. However, the university may not segregate students who intend to keep a weapon in a dormitory room to a separate building, floor, or area of the university. And on page 3, lines 16 through 19, specifies the university may not require written permission before a person may possess a firearm on campus, and the university may not adopt implied consent policies regarding restricted possession of concealed handguns or knives. Then on page 3, lines 30 through 31, adds a definition of lockbox to mean a metal hard-side container designed to enclose or encase handguns with a built-in locking mechanism. Those are all the changes, Madam Chair.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 2, line 5, we'll actually go up to line 1. The Board of Regents may not regulate the possession, ownership, use, carrying, registration, storage, or transportation of concealed handguns and knives, except, go to line 5, 2, in student dormitories or their shared living quarters. Does the language down on line 25 prevent the university from coming up with a regulation that bans it from the dorm in totality?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, the language on line 21 and 22 of the same, on page 2, it states, if the Board of Regents adopts a policy under B2 of this section, the policy must require that if the owner of the concealed handgun, and then it goes into those requirements.
Okay. Madam Chair, just want to make sure. So up top again, it says, may not regulate the possession, ownership, use, carrying, registration, et cetera, of handguns or knives, except in student dormitories that are shared living quarters. Again, I'm not sure of the answer, but the question is, can they just ban them?
I'm not sure if they can ban them outright as a result of that section 2, B2.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I think that what the senator is getting to is, or the point, is that in D, the legislature determines how the Board of Regents may regulate, and that is consistent with the major portion of the bill, which is that the legislature has the right to do that, not the regents.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Burns, did you have comments to offer on that?
Madam Chair, just to reemphasize that the language in B2 allows an exception to how the Board of Regents may regulate concealed weapons. And then if they adopt those regulations, they must be in conformity with the language in subsection D, which is lines 21 and going through page 3. So.
Further questions? I have a couple. Mr. Burns, is there a reason there's not an effective date on this? I'm worried if the bill were signed into law during a current semester, how does that work in allowing the university to do whatever the university does to make sure in regards to student safety that they have appropriate policies ready to go for a semester? So they have summer semesters where they typically may have fewer students on campuses, and then there's the fall semester of 2017. I don't see an effective date, so is there a reason?
Madam Chair, initially the bill had contained a delayed effective date that would theoretically extend the effective date of the bill to 120 days past the signing. That was removed in the Senate Education Committee. The reasoning behind that was that we didn't want to delay the university's ability, or excuse me, delay students' ability to possess a handgun on campus, and our expectations the university would adopt conforming policies accordingly. So.
Senator Kelly, I don't know how often the Board of Regents meet. Do they meet on a monthly basis, a quarterly basis?
They meet 4 times a year, but they also meet on teleconference throughout the year. Actually, I think they meet 6 times a year, and they meet on teleconference throughout the year.
So I have a concern that we don't have an effective date, because if we're going to change policy, then the university needs to be given an opportunity to actually put the policy out there. Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, line 31, why do we have for more than one day? To me, it seems it's going to be very hard to prove whether it's 1, 2, 3 days. Why can't... So I'm wondering why we're listing one day.
Mr. Burns.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the one of the concerns that the university had raised with weapons being inside dormitory rooms was the very real problem of theft inside dormitories. By limiting the presence of a handgun inside a lockbox for more than one day, it decreases the likelihood that the lockbox containing a handgun could be stolen if the student was away for a prolonged period of time. The language was designed to make sure that the student owning the handgun inside the dormitory was accountable for that weapon, and that weapon was accounted for at all times.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I think the last thing Mr. Burns was talking about is an important point. If you are a gun owner, you are expected to be responsible and to be in possession of that gun and control that gun as much as is practically possible. Sometimes students leave for long periods of time. Sometimes there's a death in the family or something, and they have to go back to their own community for a long period of time. But we don't want that gun just sitting there, not in the control of the owner for long periods of time, where it can be stolen or used by others. So the one day is a fairly strict requirement, but it is not strict really in the gun world, where you're expected to be in control of the weapons that you own.
Are there other questions? Mr. Burns, I have one more. I know that other college campuses allow guns on campuses. How does the bill presented by your senator either deviate or is similar to, as I understand it, Utah has allows weapons. I think there are several different campuses that I've been made aware of that have policies regarding guns on campuses. So how have they dealt with the issues, and how similar or how different is the bill before us or the CS?
Senator McKinnon, so 8 different states have adopted have laws in place that require public institutions or public universities to allow students or faculty to carry concealed weapons on campus. And on top of that, there's over 150 different college campuses that have policies that allow concealed carry on campus that may not be public institutions. Of the 8, 2 Oregon and Colorado, the policies there were not instituted legislatively. Those were instituted judicially when the courts found that university gun bans were in conflict with concealed carry laws in the state. In the places where it has been instituted legislatively, depending on the jurisdiction, there are different carve-outs. So in Utah, they have, similar to this bill, they allow for restricted access areas on campus that must be designated by the university. So the university may select an area that is restricted, but there's a screening process in order to make sure that area actually does not have weapons inside it. So, and that provision is across all public buildings, but it's inclusive of their universities. In other places, it's persons that carry concealed handgun licenses or permits, depending on the jurisdiction. The systems are not completely analogous all the way through. They all allow some form of concealed carry on campus, but the mechanisms on how they do it differs between the jurisdictions.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Burns was saying, you know, with 150 campuses in 8 states, all of them have different laws. They have adopted different ways of dealing with them. The point of this bill, and it was the point probably with many, and not only probably, but in some of the documents we read with other campuses, they were concerned about dormitories, sexual assault areas where you're dealing with those kinds of things and disputes. Those things we've tried to accommodate the university, which had common complaints with other universities who carry out the same mission as best we could. But to be able to say how do they deal with it would be a difficult question to answer, because not only are there 150 campuses currently, but each state has different laws, and how they, the spaghetti of different laws and regulations, how they work, it's going to look different in each state.
Senator Michiki?
Just to narrow it down to that one question, how do they generally, I mean, is there any commonality on the dormitory storage issue? Because I hear what Senator Hoffman is saying on the one day, and there's no way anyone, that's unenforceable. I understand your intent. Surely we have successful programs, and we have some that have been less successful. Do we, any ideas on how the successful ones have worked for dorm storage?
Well, currently, Madam Chair.
Senator Kelly.
Currently, they just say don't do that. Hmm. And so to say it's unenforceable, well, I guess it probably is. It's unenforceable now. What we're relying on is that the law-abiding gun owners will obey the regulations as we are expecting them to obey now, but there really is no enforcement now. What essentially, and we overuse this maybe a little bit, but essentially what they have now is a sign saying, don't do that. So, of course, the fear and the genesis of the bill is that the bad guys ignore those signs and the good guys do. And so we're saying the university can regulate, and we've listed how they can regulate. And, you know, 1 day, 3 days, 6 days, I suppose they're all difficult to enforce, because how would you prove it? But currently, they don't have any way of doing that either, other than to say, don't do that.
Mr. Burns, I have a question. On page 3, line 12 and 13, the Board of Regents, the University of Alaska, and any officer, employee, or agents of the University of Alaska may not create a database or registry for persons who possess a firearm, require written permission before a person may possess a firearm, or adopt and implement consent policy regarding restricted possession of concealed handguns or knives. Mr. Burns, how will the university, if they can't have a database, and a student requests not to be near another student who has a gun, how is the university implementing that policy?
Through the chair, so this was drafted to be self-consistent by legislative, I assume. We added the language in on lines 3 through 11 on page 3 that discusses how the university may collect and store that information. Our intention was to try to balance the privacy of the individuals who wish to carry on campus. However, with that very real, the need of the university to make housing decisions for students that may not wish to room with someone that possesses a handgun. So the intention of the language in lines 3 through 11 was to create an exception for that.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, the idea is that we don't want the university now creating a gun registry, essentially, if they are able to keep the data and then not expunge it after a certain period of time. Then over time, they're keeping essentially a database of gun ownership, which we don't want to do. However, they do have some unique circumstances in which people, particularly in dormitories, need to be able to manage that in some fashion for the people that don't want to room with people with guns. We allow them to do that for a period of time, and that is that in subsection C.
Senator Kelly, I believe you've got a contradiction going, and I don't know that it gives you, I don't know if your language, it's your bill, I don't know if C is going to overtake F, because we are saying that specifically on F, page 3, line 12, is saying that the university may not create a database, and I understood and actually support that we want information destroyed, and we don't want tracking of folks who are carrying. I just think that there's a contradiction in the bill, in the CS that we have. Mr. Burns.
If I may, so on page 3, line 4, it says, regarding a student who intends to keep a weapon, and then on page 3, line 14, persons who possess a firearm, perhaps this is where there's a split. It's by saying that you intend to carry a firearm, it's not that you possess one. Obviously, the desire was to protect the privacy of those who choose to carry on campus.
Do we have anybody from the legislative legal online? Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, my interpretation of this is when you send out information to prospective students that are coming in usually as freshmen or they're coming into the dorm for the first time, they'll have a checklist to try and match you up with an individual that you want to room with. It used to be years ago, no smoking, loud music, early riser, late goer to bedder, that sort of thing. And that my understanding in reading this is that would be on that particular form. So it's not considered a registry per se, but it's considered a matchup for the dorm. No other place are you required to demonstrate that you have registered or otherwise make note that you possess a firearm as you're walking on campus or going from class to class. Again, it's my interpretation that this is just merely to match folks up and when it comes to things like roommates.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I'll dig into this with Ledge Legal and see if there is an inconsistency there, and we'll fix it.
I think Senator Dunleavy's offered a route to through the forms that, right, that may be work effective. Any further questions for Mr. Burns? Mr. Burns, thank you for introducing the CS. I'll withdraw my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill number 174, Finance, Version I, is adopted. Mr. Christensen, would you like to come up and provide comments on the CS? Senator Kelly, I have my only remaining comment is on the effective date, and so
sure,
if you could. Well, we have several folks online. Is it Mike? Mr. Mike Costina, are you there and available for comment on the CS for Senate Bill 174, Finance?
Yes, Senator McKinnon, thank you very much. A couple of concerns and comments. The CS removes a provision that would have allowed the university to regulate firearms in cases where a process determined that a student or an employee posed a risk of harm to self or others. That's an enormous concern because it poses an obstacle to the university dealing with those very specific situations where a student is, for example, suicidal, assaultive, etc., and leaves us with limited options of excluding the person from campus or trying to obtain a Title 47 commitment, which is rare and generally isn't, is a rare situation. So that's a significant concern dealing with troubled individuals on campus, which is a common occurrence. Couple of other concerns, restricted access areas still, the bill would provide us some ability to allow or to regulate firearms in certain areas, but they must be beyond a secure point where visitors are screened. And you know, we appreciate the fact that we can establish those, but it is a bit unclear as to what a secure point is, and that could be expensive depending on the outcome of that litigation, I presume, since the law is unclear. Because the bill now allows the university to regulate only the carrying of only the carrying of long guns, it's of a long gun in a dormitory room. So that's another concern. It doesn't seem to be clear whether the university may regulate firearms in dorms. I take it from the comments by Mr. Burns that the university would be required to permit concealed handguns in dorms with only those restrictions in, Section D. And then finally, the issue you mentioned, the inconsistency between Sections E and F, it seems like that might be solved relatively simply by saying that in F1, except as provided in Section E. I believe that inconsistency could be solved. I think those are the major concerns we would have with the bill and with its CS.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair to counsel with the university. Currently, you allow guns on campus if, for example, if they're locked in one's car, correct?
That's correct, Senator Dunleavy.
And we don't differentiate whether they're long guns, short guns, et cetera, do we?
No, Senator Dunleavy.
And do you have on as part of your process currently the ability to deny an individual the right to have a gun on campus in their car as a result of conditions you feel may be, I'm trying to do the best I can to word this, but problematic individual, like you said, might be suicidal, et cetera. Do you have a written policy in place now that deals with those guns that are in those trunks and locked?
Senator Dunleavy, to the chair, no. State law prohibits us from regulating weapons in cars in parking lots.
Thank you, Mr. Hostina. Are there further questions? Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, just a point that the secure point language is in the bill is the same that we have in the municipal regulations of firearms and statute.
Mr. Cooper, did you have a comment for the committee to consider? Mr. Cooper is from the University of Alaska. Are you just listening, or did you have comments on the CS?
Senator McKinnon, Matt Cooper, Associate General Counsel for the University of Alaska. I'll just add to Mr. Hostina's comments that, as I'm sure the committee is aware, the Board of Regents had asked for two additional amendments to the bill, including the ability to regulate concealed handguns and knives in facilities where K-12 students are present, and to add a requirement that to carry a concealed handgun, a person would have to have a state-issued permit, and of course those two additions are not in the CS. I just want to point that out, that those are two amendments that the Board of Regents had requested. I guess another thing that maybe worth pointing out is the terminology that's used in the bill. We go between concealed handguns and knives, firearms, and weapons, and which creates some ambiguity in places about what exactly we're talking about under certain circumstances. So I just bring that to the committee's attention as something they may wish to look at, how those terms are used internally throughout the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Senator Kelly, comment?
The only comment I had is that mostly what we've heard is that some of the things are unclear, but what is clear is that the people of Alaska are allowed to carry, and the university is specifically, in disregard to the Constitution and the statutes that we have, says that people cannot carry, and that's clear. So what we've tried to do is make as many accommodations to the university as possible so that they can meet the spirit of the law that allows Alaskans to carry weapons. Furthermore, it's a broken record with the Regents that what they're saying, when there were other amendments that have not been added, is that we adopted a number of amendments to address their concerns, but what he's saying is we did not adopt all of them, so they aren't going to support the bill. Fact is, they're not going to support the bill even if we adopt all of them. They don't like the bill. They want the ability to regulate beyond the Constitution, beyond the statutes, as if they are a political substitute, a subdivision separate from the state of Alaska, and they're not. So we have tried to compromise. We have successfully compromised. They have not. And as the bill goes forward, they will continue to be unclear. They will continue to have concerns because of that fact. They don't want the state to be able to regulate this. They don't want us to regulate them, and they fight it at every opportunity.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. We have two additional folks. Mr. David Hansen from the Alaska State Troopers, do you have comments on the CS before us?
No, Madam Chair. I'm just available to answer any technical questions regarding general law enforcement questions.
Thank you. Mr. Eric Gaffney, Department of Public Safety in Anchorage, do you have any questions on the CS or comments?
No. I'm simply here to answer questions if necessary.
Thank you very much. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have the CS for Senate Bill number 174, Finance, adopted and before us. The public hearing was closed. 29-LS1306-I. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of hearing.
The conceptual amendment is to move the effective date to August 1st, 2016, consistent with the conversation that we had about the ability of the university to prepare for the upcoming semester.
Is there questions on conceptual amendment number one? I'll withdraw my objection.
Madam Chair.
Conceptual amendment number one is adopted. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment number two.
I'll object for purposes of hearing.
On page 3, line 13, insert the words except as provided for in section E. And Madam Chair, I will defer to you to explain this language.
Senator Kelly, we heard from a university legal representative if on line 13 after the word may not, we insert except as provided for in section E, it should clear up the inconsistency between the a permanent record status and a temporary status to allow students who are wanting to be housed away from those students with firearms that could happen. Questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Brief at ease, very quick.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We had some discussion about those students who may have already applied for the fall semester, and so it is the committee. Senator Kelly, do you want to talk about it? It's our expectation that the university, if they have already received applications, would go back through and provide those students an opportunity to check off the box if they plan on carrying a handgun. Senator Kelly.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I nothing prohibits the university from managing at that level. And if it does, well, it'll become apparent as the bill moves forward, and I'll change that because I think that's a reasonable consideration.
I'll withdraw my objection to the adoption of conceptual amendment number 2. Is there further objection? Seeing and hearing none, I direct legislative legal to make technical and conforming changes to our conceptual amendments when drafting the CS for movement to the Rules Committee. Senator Machicki, can you walk us through the fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair. In fiscal note, I only have one from the University of Alaska. The allocation is budget reductions, additions system-wide, and the OMB component number is 1296. Before I read the note, Madam Chair, I'd like to read this little legislative finance analysis footnote dated 3/14 of 16 on this bill. It says the cost of regulating the carrying of concealed handguns and knives at the university is indeterminate. Although the university has projected a fiscal note of $1.3 million UGF and a services contract for FY17 and $800,000 UGF as a steady cost in the out years, these amounts cannot be verified. Similar efforts at other state universities project up to three times the initial amount shown in the UA fiscal note. With that, Madam Chair, this fiscal note is indeterminate for FY17 through FY22. Which essentially means it's a zero fiscal note.
Senator Machicki, we have amended the fiscal note. There's a proposal to amend the fiscal note in Senate Finance to zero for FY17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22. Is there objection to zeroing the fiscal note? Seeing none, the fiscal note has been amended to zero. Senator Machicki, any other comments on the fiscal note?
No, Madam Chair, I have a question for the sponsor on the fiscal note issue. If I'm assuming that if there is a legitimate management cost in the future that we're willing to cover the university on these changes. And when I say legitimate, something that we realize is an appropriate expense related to Senate Bill 174.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I don't have any objection to that. I will say, and this is anecdotal, that some of the universities that in other states that put forth extremely high fiscal notes, that the reality is that they're not spending that much money to accommodate. It's anecdotal at this time. I couldn't give you a list of them. But that is, as I understand the case.
Senator Kelly, as I understand it, our legislative finance looked at the fiscal notes elsewhere and would concur with that statement that the fiscal notes typically tend to be inflated coming from the universities, at least from the analysis that our team has done. Any further comments on the CS for Senate Bill number 174, Finance /I? Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 174 Finance, version 29-LS1306, /I, from committee with attached fiscal note, with forthcoming fiscal notes and committee recommendations. Is that the proper motion?
Briefities. Back on the record, Senator Kelly, could I have you restate your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 174 Finance, 29-LS1306, /I, as amended from committee with attached zero fiscal note
and forthcoming fiscal notes as well, with committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill number 174, Finance, I, as amended in committee, moves from committee with attached individual recommendations and forthcoming updated fiscal note. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Good morning. It is still Monday, April 4th, 2016. It is 10:33 a.m. We've just concluded the business for the day. We took up SB 91 and adopted a new CS. We are holding SB 145. It's the daycare assistance and child care grants as we try to get someone to talk to us about a $500,000 GF spend in the bill, which is offset by a reduction in federal dollars coming into the state. We moved out of committee SB 170 and 174. It's my intention later today to bring back up SB 145 and hear from the department finance about why there is a necessary addition of $500,000 worth of spend. We've removed from this afternoon's agenda SB 207, teachers' retirement contributions, 208, eliminate Alaska Performance Scholarship, SB 209, PERS employer contributions, and SB 210, community revenue sharing. There was public testimony scheduled for that. We're in receipt of a document from Callan that we're exploring. Those were a suite of bills to help us address some of the fiscal situation the state is facing. We were notified from our finance team that there is good news inside of us actually making a request of Callan to run the numbers again, and they look much better than they did prior to the introduction of those particular bills for conversation. So that's not to say they won't move forward, but it is to say that we're reviewing the status as that suite moves together versus any of those bills independently. On Tuesday, we have the omnibus crime bill back before us. We expect to take up the fiscal notes at that time. I've been told it wasn't Callan that we made the request of, it was Buck. So Buck provided us a new analysis. I apologize. I work with Callan on the 114-128 SB conversation. So we have multiple actuaries working for us right now. So on Tuesday, we'll take up the fiscal notes and understand the fiscal notes. Wednesday, we have SB 114, 128, and 138 back before us at 1 p.m. On Wednesday at 5 p.m., we have SB 168, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, SB 172, Fish, Shellfish, Hatchery, and Enhancement Projects. Have to go to the third page of this to keep everyone informed. On Thursday at 9 a.m., we'll have 114 and 128 back before us. That's the permanent fund earnings, deposits, and dividends accounts. Thursday at 1 o'clock, we'll start the capital budget, SB 138. Thursday, April 7th at 5 p.m., we'll take up SB 205, approval of sale of royalty oil to Tesoro. On Friday, April 8th, at 8 a.m., we'll have SB 114 and SB 128 permanent fund earnings deposit accounts back before us. And, of course, at any of these times, previous bills that have been heard before could come back up, but we try to make sure that all committee members as well as the public are noticed on that as soon as we know about it. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, excuse me. The listing of bills on Wednesday again? Sorry.
On Wednesday at 9 a.m., we have the omnibus crime bill that we hope to move out. At 1 o'clock, we have SB 114 and SB 128, the permanent fund earnings deposit accounts and dividends. And what I failed to say, I believe, is SB 138, the capital budget public testimony, takes place beginning at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, April 6th. Was that what we were looking for?
There was a bill, a counterman bill. I was just wondering if it was listed.
It was supposed to be.
That was my understanding.
What was it called?
Counterman amendment was scheduled for Wednesday.
It's not listed, and I'll see what happened.
Thank you.
It was on my list. Thank you. Anything else to come before the committee? With that, we're adjourned.